Welcome to Infinite Consciousness this week, and thanks for listening. This is Eva Herr, and tonight we have with us Dr. Eldon Taylor, and we're going to talk about his new book, Choices and Illusions, on the topic of consciousness. How are you, Dr. Taylor?
I'm excellent. Just call me Eldon, please, Eva.
Okay. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Well, it's my pleasure. My pleasure indeed.
So before we get started, why don't you tell my listeners a little bit about you, where they can find your show in case they want to look at your stuff while we're talking.
Well, that's wonderful.
And a little bit about your background.
All right. Well, I have two PhDs, one in pastoral psychology, metaphysics, one in clinical psychology. For all intent and purposes, I put myself through school. And during that period of time, I was a practicing criminalist, and that is essentially how I came into the area of self-improvement, if you will. One of the things that I did as a practicing criminalist was run lie detection examinations. And in the early 80s, we conducted the first of its kind, a double-blind study at the Utah State Prison, that for all intent and purposes changed my life. Turned the direction which I went, and turned my work, and turned my research. Choices and Illusions tells that story, and tells a lot about myself, because in the process of doing this work, what I learned is something that Gerald Jampolsky says very well. We tend to teach what we want to learn. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately for myself at the time, I didn't realize that was what I was doing. I really thought I had the world by the tail. I was making lots of money. I was, you know, a 4.0 student. I didn't realize that there were many inadequacies. In very real sense, what I try to show in Choices and Illusions is we, most of us, functionally operate as though we were mindless. We do so thinking that we're making choices that indeed are illusions. It's almost as if we had four or five alternatives, like a multiple choice question, and we choose between those alternatives when indeed there's an entire alphabet and we're just not aware of it. But given this opportunity, what I try to do then for all of the listeners out there is tell you, first of all, if you go to my website, choicesandillusions.com, is choicesandillusions.com. There are free gifts there, including a program that we'll talk about later at some point in this show that was a turning point for me and for the inmates at the Utah State Prison, and I have found since then works in every domain, in every area of or walk of life to empower an individual in ways that they've just never before realized were possible. And that program is there, and it's just indicated as free. You can click on that. There are a number of illusions that are audio illusions, visual illusions, things that appear that aren't there, that will just come right straight out of the wall and get three-dimensional on you. So it's a fun site to go to and a fun place to visit, but it's also designed to assist every human being in understanding that, in a very real sense, I can't change my life, and we're all coming up on the new year, and we're all looking at resolutions. I'm not going to make any substantive changes unless I get to the issues that have created the problem that I want to change. Does that make sense to you?
Oh, yeah. We can all use that. I can tell you that for sure. It's a way to change, a way to grow. So I'm curious, what was your research in the prison?
Well, what we did, I'm going to have to digress, Eva. I hate to digress, but practicing as a criminalist, I happened to come across an announcement that essentially indicated that the Los Angeles Police Department had used a technology that they had planned to use in the 92 Olympics in case there was an abduction. And in using this technology, they had dehydrated their cadets, and so they'd suspended the experiment. Now, by design, it was supposed to dehydrate anyone that would be listening to it. And that's a whole other story as to why and what. But the bottom line was, I read this about this technology, and it was called Subliminal. And I was familiar with subliminal processing, information processing, by way of like the tachetoscope and flashing or inserting slides, as James Vickery claimed he did in The Picnic, the movie Picnic. You know, drink Coca-Cola and eat popcorn, everybody knows about that. But the approach of using something that was auditory was something that was new to me. And so I initially looked at this as, you know what, this may solve a problem that I have and every lie detection examiner has, and that's called inconclusives. We have a certain number of individuals that will come in for a test that intend to be honest and are very honest, but indeed they're frightened of being determined to be dishonest, and so what we call situational stress skews their responses sufficiently that we end up calling them inconclusive. And, you know, every employer that sends you someone, every law enforcement officer that sends you something hates that one. Inconclusive simply means, you know, I can't tell you if they're telling me the truth, or I can't tell you if they're lying to me. And then, of course, there are those that are sophisticated with their countermeasures and other techniques that can also bring about inconclusives. And so the idea was, you know, if you could use this technology to do what the LAPD Academy purportedly had done, by the way, I was never able to verify that, and no one has ever stepped forward and denied it either, but if you were able to do that, what if I could use the technology to eliminate my inconclusives? Well, that had a big dollar incentive to me. And so I went after finding out how to do this, what this technology was, and how it could be used. And what I found is the more people I talked to, you would have thought I was asking about Coca-Cola's secret recipe. There were lots and lots of claims out there, lots of people that were selling product or offering to do things with it, increase your sales and decrease the theft in your business. But when you got down to what is the technical, there was no information that was available. And, you know, now as a scientist, if you're going to conduct a study, if you're going to look at something, if you're going to make a scientific claim, you've got to disclose what you did and how you did it. And so, obviously, there was no literature to indicate in the audio range efficacy of any nature unless it was within a enclosed room where we controlled the ambient noise and we tested the hearing, and then we deliberately found a threshold and back just underneath that threshold in a way that could not be employed in real life world. Well, to make a long story short, I sent a number of programs that I got from everybody out there to Anthony Pelicano in Los Angeles at Audio Forensic Laboratories, and that's what Anthony does, and he does it typically for law enforcement and attorneys, and you get in line to get Anthony. But he took a look at him for me, and he essentially said, you know, Eldon, there's nothing on here. So what I started to do at that early point was try and determine how you could, because the idea was solidly planted in my mind, how you could develop a technology that would put a new stream of consciousness in a person's mind so that when they began to talk to themselves, when their self-talk, their inner talk, started to come out, it agreed with their stated objective. Because it was very clear to me in all the work that I had done, including criminalistics, that the difference between, you know, someone that says, I'm going to make $1 million this year, and they get the back talk that says, sure, what are you going to do, rob a bank? And a Bill Gates is belief, self-belief. And so what I did is I began to work with this. Now, just to jump further forward, it worked very well in the lie detection scenario. Our inconclusives nearly disappeared, and suddenly we were getting confessions at a much quicker, earlier rate than we'd ever experienced. I passed the word around to some examiners, and some other examiners started to work with what I developed, and then we got the word that, you know, probably wasn't a good idea to do that, and so we discontinued it. But in the process, I talked to some people at the university, and I talked to some other people, and an associate of mine, a friend of mine, came to me that was in the social care department at the University of Utah. He's a social worker. And actually, he was a custodian and had moved from custodial care over to social work. And asked me, could we use this technology to assist inmates to lower the hostility and the aggression and to perhaps interdict the recidivity rate? And so, you know, at his bequest and origin, I got another friend of mine, Charles McCuster, a stat psychologist who did a lot of work for the state of Utah. We got approvals, and we did our first double-blind study at the Utah State Prison, attempting to do precisely that, lower hostility and aggression in the prison and interrupt recidivity rates. Well, when we went in, and Eva, jump in here any time, okay? When we went into the prison system, what we looked to do was, you know, find some common denominator that would give us, a way to re-script the self-talk of these inmates so that, for all intent and purposes, we could effectively lower this aggression and hostility. And that was fun. I mean, we started with the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory, fully augmented psychometrics through the computer using a special prison lens, and got nothing that you wouldn't expect. High scores in self and social alienation. But when we sat down and talked to the inmates and then started bouncing what we got back and forth with each other, it became clear that the inmate displaced responsibility for what they had done. In other words, ah, but for the grace of God, there go you, or there go I. That was their attitude. They had something to blame it on. Sometimes the stories were sincere and genuine, and sometimes they were just, really exaggerated. My daddy was an alcoholic. My mommy was a prostitute. The neighbor boy mainlined me when I was 8 years old. Those kinds of things. Now, even when we had tragic, true stories, you could have two brothers. One had gone off and was a teaching professor in a medical school, and the other one was the one we were dealing with in the prison system. So they had the same stimulus, but they had made different decisions.
I have a question here.
What we decided to do then was we're going to have to interrupt this abdication of responsibility. We're going to have to go to these people in a way that gets them to take responsibility for their decisions, irrespective of what the stimuli is. So all of us, we face stimulus that we may not be in control of, but we are in control of how we respond to it, to a larger part at least, okay?
I have a question here.
Yeah.
It's kind of hard to say this, so get out what I want to say, but I assume that some of their stimulus would be based on conditioning of mind. But we also know that if people have, let's say, too much norepinephrine, that can cause them to get aggressive and angry. Does this work in that kind of case, too, when it's like a chemical imbalance case?
Well, the answer is, let's back up. When you say conditioned of mind, we're all conditioned of mind. And remember I said, starting this story, that we teach what we want to learn. What I learned out of the prison system is yes and yes to you, to your questions, simplified. But what I learned out of the prison system was I wasn't any different than these inmates, except for the fact I had not broken the law. Mm-hmm. In other words, I got angry just like everybody else did. That was normal. I mean, everybody knows that's normal. I mean, there are bumper stickers everywhere. Thank God it's Friday. I don't get even. I get evener. Da 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 da. Go ahead and make my day. We've all seen that. We've all heard that. Those are the one-liners. It wasn't any different with the inmates. Well, I blamed people just like they did. I blamed things in my life. In a very real sense, if you ask a child, why did you do that? That young child's going to give you a story. We all know that. Well, my little brother said this first. Well, this guy did this to me first. Part of the growing up process is separating that and taking responsibility for who and what we are. There are two ways to be tied up in the world, Eva. One is, somebody can just literally physically tie us, bind us. Another one is somebody can hand us a thread attached to a doorknob And we can decide not to let go of it or to pull hard enough to break it, to challenge it. And most of us have been imprinted, just like a duckling in a chicken yard, imprinted by our peers and our parents and the media and the gaming that we do for young people today. We're imprinted, and we begin to practice a behavior based on a model in our mind that is what we want to be. So if you're a young boy and you're playing all these, you know, aggressive, violent games, and you get this, you know, you want a piece of me, boy, the kind of conversation that comes out of so many of these video games, then you see these young people begin to practice that as well. Well, all of this by way of behavior affects the physical chemistry of the body. Absolutely, totally. Indeed, you know, a complete opposite example is if you smile, just fake it. It's really hard. You're having a terrible day, but you force the corners of your mouth up. You force a smile up. You fool the brain. It doesn't know you're faking it. And the brain chemistry changes. It pumps on those chemicals like dopamine that make us feel better. The euphoric chemicals that we laugh with, that we enjoy. And that's hardwired. Our attitude, we know today, it definitely influences not just the disposition of how the body handles things. The body, you know, analogous to a government, has essentially two budgets. One is growth and the other is defense. If you're angry, if you're blaming, if you're hostile, if you're aggressive, if you're, you know, feeling shameful and introverted and depressed, you have placed the body in defense. And, of course, when you do that, little things like the endocrine, the immune, and the ANS system just don't work optimally. So, you know, again, coming back to the prison, what we had to do was undo this ability that seemed to be a product of everyone to displace the responsibility and blame. And doing that, I settled on something way back in the early 80s that today you can find everywhere in the literature, but at the time was revolutionary. We're going to use three affirmations, and then we'll use some self-esteem building affirmations, but we'll use, I forgive myself, I forgive all others, I am forgiven. Now, those three affirmations essentially make it impossible for you to continue to blame. If I forgive everyone, who am I going to blame? Now, once I've done that process, I'm empowered to do something about whatever the situation was.
People are going to say, but what button on me do I push to forgive? It's so strong, I can't let go. So what do they do?
Well, you know, we can be addicted to our own self-destructive patterns, can't we?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if somebody says, I just can't forgive, you know, the answer to that is you must not want to. Because if you change that just a little and you say, I have been unable to forgive up until now, what can I do? Well, then the context completely changes, doesn't it? So, what can you do? Well, you can go to this website, choicesandillusions.com, that I told you about. You can click on the free forgiveness program, and you can download it or get a CD absolutely free that uses this patented technology that I ended up developing, that we used in the prison system, used in the hospice centers, have used with Fortune 500 executives, have used with elite athletes, gold medalists, all very successfully, and you can get it absolutely free. In my opinion, that's where self-improvement begins. Because if you can't take responsibility for everything in your life, if you're unwilling to do that, well, then you've effectively tied yourself up. Mm-hmm. You've effectively chosen to displace your power and give it to someone else. And in that sense, we all know, well, then we become the puppet of someone else's strings.
What would we hear on one of your CDs? Give us an example.
Well, this particular CD has those three affirmations. It's going to have a number of other affirmations that are all esteem-building affirmations. I love life. Life is good. Living is wonderful. Life is a miracle. I am good. I deserve. I am healthy. I am optimistic. That kind of thing. And you can look at the website. It tells you what's on there. We don't try and hide anything. Indeed, my books, I tell you, you need to know this information. But by using this special dichotic masking technology, we can get the information into your mind, into your self-talk, bypassing critical awareness. Now, what does that do? Well, that means it just enters your stream of consciousness. It becomes your thought. You begin to think this from the inside out. So you don't say to yourself, I am deserving. Yeah, deserving what? You remember what you did? Or, you know, you don't find yourself habitually reacting mindlessly.
How long do you have to listen to it before?
Our research, Eva, shows, and we've done research on this, that if you use the program a minimum of an hour a day, every day for 30 days, we'll be able to measure a statistical difference in whatever the domain is that you're working with. So, clinical depression, an hour a day, every day for 30 days, and essentially, according to the Beck Depression Scale, we move from depressed to non-depressed. ADHD, the same thing. Weight loss, we weigh people. Stress, all these studies have been actually conducted on this technology I'm telling you about that we call InnerTalk, and they're available at my site. And you can simply go there and you can look at it. In fact, if you go to my parents' site, progressiveawareness.org, you can see over 1,200 studies that have been conducted.
That's amazing.
So the bottom line is it works, but the most important thing is you don't even have to get the program if what you'll do is change the way you're thinking, change the way you talk to yourself. The problem with just claiming that I'm going to do that comes back to the resolutions that we... You know, mention we're coming up on resolutions. People are going to make resolutions. In a month from now, they're going to have broken those resolutions. And every single human being that I've ever talked to has experienced something like going to a rally, a pep rally, or going to a special motivational program, or listening to a great speaker, and that speaker gets them motivated. And maybe so motivated that they even get goosebumps at a point, and they're just really excited, and this is for me. And you know, when we take great speakers that charge thousands of dollars for you to attend their conferences, and we ask them as they leave in an exit poll, you know, what was this worth to you? Oh, it was just wonderful. It was just fantastic. It's going to change my life. And that's what we get from the preponderance of people, the vast majority of people. 30 days later, what we get from him is, well, you know, I haven't got around to it yet. Well, I thought about it. It doesn't fit my personality. Well, you know, some of the ideas are good, but I'm going to another seminar next week, and I'm going to wait until I get those, and maybe I can, you know, put them together in a better way. You know, and all that comes down to procrastination, rationalization, you know. There's something that, for all intent and purposes, I think of as the three thieves. You know, they've been called the three shyster. When we rationalize, justify, or deny, we're cheating ourselves.
Go ahead.
If each of us desires to make a change, then we owe it to ourselves to look at why we haven't changed up to now and to do something that changes that. Because until we do, we won't make the change.
Something in your book really interested me, something you wrote, a piece that you wrote, sticks and stones will break my bones, but words will slice and dice me.
Absolutely.
I don't think people focus enough on what words they choose to communicate with people. They don't realize what those words are doing.
You know, I concur with you totally, and I've talked to a lot of parents that when they realize what they've done, they really regret some of the things they said. And I'm talking about the best parents, informed parents. You know, I think all of us slip from time to time in our haste, and we say something that injures another human being. And you know, that's going to happen. And the fact of the world is, if we don't live in a vacuum, you or I or anyone else. And so we're going to be surrounded with negative information. If we turn on the television set, we're going to be pounded with
right.
it. If every listener, every one of our listeners out there thinks about how they grew up, there was a point in their life when they were being told things that we all call, or what I call, the no-don't syndrome. There were the things that you can't do this, no, don't do that, you're too stupid for that, you're not pretty enough, you're not handsome enough, you're not tall enough, you're not smart enough, you'll never amount to this, you can't, you know, all of that negativity. And sometimes it's very forceful. You're ugly, you know, that was a stupid remark, you're stupid, shut up, you don't deserve, you know. All those kinds of things that get said to us, they're stored. They're stored in our mind. You know, and for all intent and purposes, all of us want to avoid pain. I mean, that's just a part of life. Part of being human means that I want to avoid pain. I want to seek pleasure, which includes, of course, arousal, and I need to be loved. I mean, that is just part and parcel of being a human being.
Right.
All right. Now,
I just need to, I'd like to put this in there and have you talk about this for. And I was having a conversation with someone the other day about what is abuse. And the person said, well, it's hitting and such as that. And I said, well, verbal abuse can be just as painful. And they said, no, that words don't hurt. You know, it's not even close to hitting someone. But it is. They do hurt.
Immensely. You know, look, you can black somebody's eye and it will heal. And a month later, you'll never know that they had a black eye. But the emotional damage may never heal. Words are emotional. Every single word that we know, we have attached an emotional content to. We think of a color, and there are colors that, well, that's better than this color. That's an emotional content. We think of words that are good or bad words, and they have a content. We basically, for all intent and purposes, receive the information not just intellectually, not just semantically, but emotionally. When someone says something to us, it is a feeling something if it's someone that matters. So when we store that emotion, it is the same emotion that might be stored as a result of a punch that blackened an eye and makes the person just as fearful and causes the same kind of emotional trauma that a physical blow would do. What we don't realize about words is that in our process of attempting, you know, look, I'm going to back up. If you swing at me, I can duck. I can stay away from you if I think you're going to hit me. But words are something that are much harder to get out of the way of. They're something that we store and something that we hear over and over again. We play them in our mind. We may even practice how we should have responded or what we might have said and rehearse these scripts so that we distort the memories in the process and the memory can become even more painful. And it becomes necessary in order for us to live with ourselves, to find joy, to have pleasure, to get rid of that pain. And there are two ways we're going to get rid of the pain. We're going to repress the memory, bury it so deeply that we're not aware of it, and we're going to build a mechanism so that we avoid it in the future. So somebody says, you know, myself, I can tell you this, when I was a child, I wanted to be a singer. I mean, I was convinced I was going to be the next Mario Lanza or Bing Crosby. And I practiced and practiced and practiced my favorite song, Vaya Con Dios. And when I'm about 8 years old, my mother pulls me out and sets me in the middle of a family reunion where my father's family, very blue collar, and my mother's family, very white collar, are locked in a political conversation. Not a nice one. And she says, my son sings. Sing. Well, my voice broke up. Tears came to my eyes. I couldn't carry a tune. I ran out of the room, and I never sang again. But I never thought about that. And then one day I was asked by a friend of mine, Professor William Gillory at the University of Utah to give a presentation to his honor students on my work. And I said, sure, because we all know honor student classes are very small. You know, 20, 30 people would be a huge one, you know. I've been in honors classes where there's six or seven. So I said, where are we meeting? He said, Kingsbury Hall. Well, now, Kingsbury Hall, the University of Utah, can accommodate about 1,200 people. Why Kingsbury Hall? Well, because the Black Chemists of America are in town, and as you know, I'm president of Black Chemists. I want them all to come. Well, something, you know, my stomach hit the ground. Now, I'm going to tell you that I was terrified of public speaking. At that time, Eva, there's no way in the world I could have done this radio show with you. Okay? I'd already told him I'd do it. So what I did is I went through the whole part of driving there, getting out of the car, starting to walk toward the hall, and realized, I can't do this. I'm terrified. I don't know what I was terrified of. So I took my long-sleeve white shirt and my sleeves, and I rolled them around my tire so it looked like I had to change a tire, and I drove away, and then I claimed I had a flat tire. It took me a long time to tell Bill what had really happened. But as serendipity would have it, a few months later, I was doing a custom program using this technology for a professional entertainer who had stage fright. And you know, I finished it on a Friday night, and I drove down to southern Utah, and I got in late, and I liked to write on the weekend, so I would drive down there because it was warm in the winter. And I was staying at a little cabin in Zions, and I got in, I put the recording on, I started to listen to it so I'd hear it before I send it out, and I fell asleep in the middle of it. Now, it's a true story. I woke in the middle of a dream. And I mean, the dream was a real-life revivification of my experience as that child being thrust out in the middle of two warring families and told to sing. And I said to my mother, you know, bless you, because she had passed over, bless you, but doggone you, Mom, how could you do that? I realized at that moment my fear of speaking, and here we were in the dream, was due to being chucked out in the middle as a child and asked to end this argument by singing. Okay? Now, what did I do? I built a mechanism, and that mechanism stopped me from not just singing and avoiding that pain, that would never happen to me again, but it stopped me from doing many other things in my life that would have changed where I am today and what I have done today, whether it's writing or having this conversation with you. Every human being will create a mechanism to avoid pain. Maybe the mechanism is, well, I'm going to armor plate myself so I'm never rejected again, and I use food improperly to assuage my anxiety and do that armor plating. Maybe the mechanism is something as simple as, I have a fear, but the fear is really based on driving me away from something that I was humiliated over in my childhood, as the instance I just explained to you. Does that make sense to you, Eva?
Mm-hmm. You talked about something else in your book that was really interesting to me, and that was reverse speaking?
Yes.
That what it was? Tell me about that. I've always been interested in that. How does that happen?
This is one of those areas where a friend of mine said, Ellen, you may win a Nobel Prize for this, and you may also just get told that you're way out on the limb and you cut it off. This is one of the controversial areas of my work, and I like to get that said right in the front so that all the listeners understand that. But then I'm going to come back and I'll back it up with solid scientific evidence, okay? And indeed, if you go to my website again, Choices and Illusions, I'll give you real-life examples. This is, as I believe it is, and as I developed what is known as the mirror imaging paradigm way back in the early 80s, at that time there was a lot of talk about holographic information processing. And Bohm had just won a Nobel Prize for his work on the holographic model of the universe. And there were researchers that were looking at memory storage as being holographic as well. One of the things that we knew at that time was areas that we thought stored memory either didn't store them completely because that area could be destroyed and the person would still have memory, and or they were being stored simultaneously somewhere else. Since then, we have learned that you can literally destroy the entire brain and you're not going to do away with the memory. So apparently, the memories are stored holographically across the entire brain. Now, what does that mean? Well, you know, children are shown today that if you take a holographic image, a photo, and you cut it into 100 little pieces and shine light through one of those little pieces, you'll see the entire picture. So what it means is that the entire memory is stored holographically across the entire brain. Now, in the early 80s, looking at this, I basically made a couple of assumptions that were based on my own work and my own experience, and triggered a little bit by serendipity again. And in that process, I saw the two hemispheres of the brain, because of their multitasking specialities, as processing language separately, the right hemisphere processing it in reverse, the left hemisphere processing according to the rules of language. This I can tell you. What we did in developing our technologies was deliver simultaneous forward and reverse messages. And because they're coming simultaneously, the brain does not want to attend to them. They're there, and if I channel differentiate my stereo, I can hear them. I can hear what sounds like talking, but I can't discriminate them. And that process is called dichotic. It's a dichotic listening approach. Now, we have taken, according to my theory, obviously, that would mean that a child would learn language in reverse. And my own experience, I had, you know, my first child looked me straight in the eye and said many things that appeared to be, to her, very sincere and very meaningful. But to me, it wasn't goo-goo gaga, it wasn't, you know, a baby talk, but it was totally non-meaningful. Now today, and again on my website, we have language conversations where small children doing exactly as I have described speak to us, we record it, we reverse it, and slow it down about 10%, and they're saying, Mommy home, Daddy play, Daddy help me, It's totally meaningful conversation. Now, at the time I was doing my work, there was another researcher by the name of David Oates who was doing pioneering work in Australia. And at the time, David had discovered that these reversals accompany normal forward speech. Well, that would make sense if we're processing language simultaneously in both forward and reverse, especially if they were Freudian in their nature. Now, everybody knows what a Freudian slip is, but how about an unconscious Freudian slip? Well, what David observed was, in criminalistics, if he were to record someone accused of a crime, as a case in point, as they gave a deposition or as they gave their story, he could play it backwards and maybe build additional information as a result of that. Sometimes it corroborated what they said. Sometimes it disclosed a truthful difference. As a result of that, in his work, he had one instance that I'll never forget, where an individual had robbed a bank and hidden money under a bridge and then driven away and was later apprehended, said he had no part of the robbery, but the reversal said he hid the money under the bridge, and they recovered the money. It was under the bridge. Many instances where someone would say, you know, you ask them, what were you doing between 5 and 6? Well, I left work, and I stopped at the grocery store, and I went home, and I got there about 5:45, and, you know, and when you play the reversal, you get bread and milk. In other words, at the grocery store, they picked up bread and milk. So the fact of the matter is, and this is a fact, how the theory goes, whether or not we're actually processing information holographically, which is what I believe we are, or not, that may yet have to be demonstrated. But the fact of the matter is, we are able to process reverse speech. We do act in reliance on the reverse speech. Small children do apparently learn to speak in forward speech after they acquire reverse speech skills. And very often, you know, if you happen to be a parent and you see your child reverse that S or reverse that 5, those kinds of reversals are so common, they happen to everybody. Maybe the next time you see one of them, hold it in the mirror and you'll see an example of exactly what we're talking about. Does that answer your question, Eva?
Yeah, but I just can't grasp how it does that. Amazing.
The brain is absolutely amazing, isn't it? It's just absolutely amazing.
I do think quantum mechanics pretty much has proven, though, that we live in a hologram. At least that's what all the scientists say that come on my show.
Well, the neuroscientists have not quite come to that point. You know, we divide our scientists, of course. We have our physicists, our quantum physicists, and then we have our neurologists and neuroscientists, and neuroscientists are working on that. And I have some friends in that. In fact, one of the writers in my book, Choices and Illusions, is Dr. Christian Inescu, and that is what he is. He's a neuroscientist, and they tend to agree, but there are those that think this is still kind of far out, and so. But that's okay, you know. The bottom line is we don't have to know what electricity is to be able to flip the light switch. So however it's being processed, we may get that down, and it may be like electricity, but what we do know is this is what happens. And to me, that country bumpkin kid that grew up in the West Side with all the blue-collar workers sees that as just a pure pragmatic answer. The fact of the matter is this is how it works, and if I know that, then I know how I can use it.
So tell us a little about the subliminal messages.
Well,
talk about that in your book too.
Yeah,
really
technically, a subliminal message, and people often get that confused. I mean, we see things all the time that are subliminal, meaning in that sense of the definition that we see it, but we don't see that we see it. So, or we don't take note of the fact that we saw. We tend to, you know, as professionals, we look at that and we say, well, that's not really subliminal, that's supraliminal. That's the beautiful model that stands next to the car that makes you think that if you have the car, you're going to also have this beautiful woman in your life. Or, you know, and you can go on and on and on with the images that are built in the media all around that. In fact, it's worth mentioning, in my opinion, Edward Bernays, because Bernays was a nephew of Sigmund Freud, and he is popularly known in America as the father of propaganda, not the propaganda the Catholic Church introduced that was designed to set the truth straight, but the propaganda as we know it today that may not be truthful, tends to be designed to sell you something. And Bernays used Freud's notions, Freud's thoughts and ideas about a psychodynamic unconscious, about you know, our behavior being built around an id, an ego, a superego, sexual desires and repression and so on and so forth. When we understand that, if we look at the modern advertising that's going on, what we can see is a lot of things that are taboos, a lot of things that are designed to elicit arousal, and of course every year that arousal has to increase and has to increase because it takes more and more stimuli. So instead of, you know, the skirt length of a woman as it was in the 50s between the ankles and, well, just a little above the ankles, I mean, we all know where they are today, we all know what we see in primetime television, and we can all contrast that to what we saw 10 years ago, 20 years ago. Some of us 30 years ago, and it's a substantial difference. Bernays is probably best known, in my opinion, for his book, Propaganda, and is an example of his work in 1929 at the Light's Golden Jubilee, celebrating the invention of the light bulb. He told the entire world Thomas Edison invented it. Thomas Edison never invented the light bulb. A fellow by the name of Joseph Swan did. But if you walk into your, you know, local high school and you ask a high school teacher, you walk into college, say nothing of elementary and middle school, or people that Thomas Edison invented the light bulb. Well, he didn't. One of the things I try to show in Choices and Illusions is we have been taught a lot of things that are just false. You know, one and one always is two. Well, it's not. Take a gallon of water and a gallon of alcohol and add them together, and they don't equal 2 gallons. It's just that simple. And that amazes lots of people. So, come back to your question. A subliminal, technically, according to the definition we would use in behavioral science, is a stimulus beneath the threshold of awareness, which would mean, well, I can, as a case in point, when George Bush ran against Al Gore and his infamous rats appeared over Gore's head, cut out of the word bureaucrats, and flashed in a single slide, every 32 slides, I have delivered a stimulus that the unconscious will recognize, but the conscious mind will not. Now, that's beneath the threshold of recognition. Do you understand?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You can do the same thing with an audio. It can be a stimulus that is beneath the threshold of recognition. Now, here's the problem with a technical definition like that. The only way for us to control audio is to put you in that enclosed room, like I mentioned to you before, where we test everything and we control the ambient background and there isn't a dishwasher going and there isn't somebody yelling at you or you're not driving in your car or you're not watching television, and we test your hearing and we deliver a tone until you get to a place where, as we've turned it down systematically, you no longer hear it. You say, I don't hear that. So you fail to report hearing it, but that would be one mark beneath your threshold. And then we begin to match that with whatever we're attempting to condition. Years ago, this is, almost 80 years, 90 years ago now, a brilliant scientist paired a silent dog whistle with electric shock. Blow the silent dog whistle, deliver electric shock. We all know about Pavlov's conditioned dogs, a certain number of deliveries, and he didn't have to deliver the shock to get a human being to jerk their hand off of the meter that delivered the shock to him. And that was a silent dog whistle. Now that we would call subliminal. Okay. When we start processing semantic information, however, a silent dog whistle isn't going to do it. We don't process language at a silent level. So therein we really run into a real quandary that has plagued a lot of the research and has put a lot of information out even in, among professionals and academics that is false. In a recent article that, in fact, it was in last month's issue of Annals, which is the Journal for American Psychotherapists. I have a journal article that is titled Revisiting the Subliminal Controversy. And the entire article is about how these definitions and the designs, the scientific designs that were built out of these definitions, have ended in confusing even the best scientists about the possibilities that exist using subliminal stimulation. So to me, now, a practical answer, and this again is that West Side Kid looking at pragmatics, a practical answer says this: if it's a stimulus that bypasses critical awareness, it's subliminal.
How fast does that kind of thing work on the mind?
Well, it depends. You know, there's a new study out of Israel that shows that with very limited, kind of exposure, you could predispose one's feelings about a nation by just simply showing them flags of that nation paired with words. We've known for a long time that we can predispose how you'll respond to a human being by showing you a picture so quickly that you don't recognize seeing it, like the one slide in 32 or a candle-watt power difference or a tachetoscope, in some way visually presenting to you the picture of a person and pairing it with words, untrustworthy, suspicious, wonderful, warm, generous. We can predispose how you will judge that person when you do see their picture or meet them in person. And that can happen very quickly. I mean, very quickly. When you look at a long term, I tend to believe that it takes a much greater exposure, and it depends on what it is that we're attempting to bring about by way of a change. But one of the questions that over 10 years ago we experimented with, we looked at with a brilliant German scientist, was can you change? If you looked at a person's belief and you put them on a calculus and you say on one end is a case in point is communism and on the other end is capitalism, can you move them along this calculus in integers from one side to the other side without them being aware, using a subliminal stimulus? And Peter Kruse, who was a researcher, conducted that study with a program that we assisted in creating, and indeed showed that in his pilot study that without a doubt you can do exactly that. That study, by the way, is also on my site. So when you say, you know, how long does it take? It depends on the individual. It depends on the nature of the situation. It depends on the stimulus. There are a lot of variables, but where 15 years ago there was a lot of argument about whether or not you could influence behavior, there's very little argument about that, and the meta-analysis of statistical data is so overwhelming as to, you know, put those people that might argue in a place where you wonder where they've been recently.
If you were to listen to your CD when you were sleeping, would it have effect on you?
Indeed, we have a lot of customers report that. I've never run that study, but I would be one that would report positively also. Not because we process information in sleep, per se. What you have to think of there is when the average adult sleeps, that typical 8 hours, 3.5 to 4.5 hours of that 8 hours is in what might be known as twilight sleep. What that means is, look, I'm going technically through hypnopompic or hypnagogic. Look, I'm falling asleep, I'm waking up. I'm falling asleep, I'm coming into dream sleep, where I'll have rapid eye movement. And this all has to do with a brainwave pattern. So I lay down on the bed, and, you know, I'm in normal beta consciousness. Maybe my brain, if I were to be measuring that on an EEG, is 15, 18, 20 cycles per second. Okay, that 20 is a little high to be going to bed, but a lot of people watch a violent movie and then go straight to bed at the end of it. So maybe it is up there. Maybe it's up to 30. But as we fall asleep, it comes down through what we call alpha. And that's, you know, as that happens, it's between at about 8 to 14 cycles per second. Dream sleep is in that same period as alpha. Now, as we go into deep sleep, everything turns inward. And so that level of sleep, we're not processing information from the outside. But in the States, going into dream sleep or into sleep, up into dream sleep, during dream sleep, and then, and for most people, that's, as I say, 3.5 to 4.5 hours in an 8-hour sleep pattern, that's a primary time for you to be putting positive suggestions in your mind of whatever kind it is. Make your own recordings. I mean, I have a book called Mind that reports work by a team of psychiatrists in New York State. The turn of the century, I believe it was 1894, but it's in the 1800s. 1894 is what hangs in my head, but don't hold me to that one. Where they used a technology they call whisper, and they simply whispered to their patients as they fell asleep, and they saw tremendous gains. the ancient Hermetic order of Asclepius and the Asclepius healing centers all lay claim to that was exactly what was done in those Greek healing centers. Was they were whispered healing patterns which brought about dreams, and of course the patient gave rise to the dream as the healing event, not the whispering. But if we realize that when an individual is in a hypnotic state, when they've been hypnotized, they technically are in an alpha brainwave state, alpha, theta brainwave state. That brainwave state is the same one they're going to experience in dream sleep. And as they fall to sleep or wake up, the twilight stages of sleep, they're going to go through that also. And that is the optimal point of suggestion. Indeed, hypnosis is defined as a hyper state of suggestibility.
Very interesting. Could hear about that all night. We've got just a couple of minutes, so take this time. We've got about 3 minutes. To say whatever it is that you would like to say that you think is most important.
Well, you know, I'd like to invite all of the listeners to go to the website and get that free forgiveness program and try this out. Just test it on yourself and see if that doesn't change your life. I guarantee it will. It is the beginning point. And, of course, I would enjoy it if you also went to the website. You'll see that there's a special offer on the book. If you click on that, it will open up a letter that is full of over $1,000 worth of free gifts that are from the real, you know, gurus, if you will, of self-help. I don't want to leave anybody out, but they're the Deepak Chopras, the Jay-Z Knights, the Joan Borisenkos, on and on and on and on. They're really prominent people, and they all have a gift just to get you to read the book. And the book is available at BarnesandNoble.com or Amazon.com. They both have it on sale for $15. And so, you know, I think you will find that if you get the free program and you get the book, those resolutions that you would like to make, you can make them real.
I'm definitely
this coming
go there.
Year.
Tell us one more time where it is, just so they make sure they have it.
Choicesanddelusions.com.
Thank you so much, Dr. Taylor, for coming on the show.
Oh, it's indeed
really
been my pleasure, and I wish you and everyone out there a wonderful new year full of everything good and bountiful.
Thank you, and good night.
Good night.
Bye-bye.